This weekend, the protests will continue in Hong Kong.
We were promised universal suffrage, which means that we could elect our own chief executive in the year 2008. Right now, we are in 2019, and we do not see that happening anytime soon.
We'll meet Denise Ho, a Hong Kong pop star. She's using her fame to send a message to Beijing. And here in the U.S., the immigration debate is especially heated right now, but we've been here before.
We are a nation of immigrants, but we are also a nation that loves to debate immigration policy. And that's been true since day one.
How we got here in the fractious debate over immigration. I'm Marco Werman. Those stories plus a gender-bending Ziggy Stardust Barbie doll. We've got the goods on that and more today here on The World. I'm Marco Werman. You're with The World on a Friday. Thanks for being here. People in Hong Kong are not giving up. More protests are planned in the coming days. Organizers say they're ready to escalate demonstrations if the Chinese government doesn't give in to their demands. The issue is Hong Kong's special status as a part of China, but with a separate democratic and legal framework. One country, two systems, it's called. Protesters and their supporters say that arrangement is now under threat. Among them, Hong Kong-born pop singer Denise Ho. Her music is popular with Hong Kongers, but if you Google the name Denise Ho right now, this is what you're more likely to find.
The Vienna Declaration guarantees democracy and human rights. Yet in Hong Kong today, these are under serious attack. Last month,
that's Denise Ho speaking to the United Nations Human Rights Council in Geneva this week. She was repeatedly interrupted by the Chinese government's representative during that session, and today a government spokesman called her delusional. Denise Ho joins us on the line from Hong Kong. These protests, Denise, started last month. There have been some dramatic scenes from the demonstrations, over a million people and some protest marches. But what has all this accomplished so far?
Yes, hello, Marco. The change that I have seen the most prominent is among the people. This is a movement that is very unique in itself because we have no leader. We have no one particular organization that is leading the crowds. It's really a very organic and a very everyone pitches in sort of a movement. Of course, we had some down moments during this month, but I have seen people becoming even more creative than we were in the beginning, changing our ways of protesting, using different tactics, and also there is a sense of coexistence between people who have different ways of doing these protests. And so this is a very big change from what we had during the Umbrella Movement, because back then there were a lot of conflicts between the people protesting. Of course, we are not seeing a very big response from the Chinese government or the Hong Kong government right now. But
maybe not a big response from Beijing. I mean, even with all these people turning out and these new tactics, you're still in the shadow of Beijing, aren't you?
Well, I mean, that is the original state of being in Hong Kong, where we are legally a part of China, but we are also legally a autonomous special administration in itself in China. And that is something that we have, from day one fighting for. Is our autonomy. Of course, there are a lot of rumors and propaganda saying that the people are requesting for Hong Kong independence, but that is just basically not true in the majority, because we have been asking, as I said in my United Nations short speech, we have been asking for our one country, two systems to be implemented properly, which has not been the case. 22 years in, we are still seeing a lot of erosion in our whole system.
Right. You mentioned in Geneva, yeah. You mentioned deceitful promises made by the central government in Beijing since the handover of Hong Kong to China in 1997. What were you referring to? What deceitful promises?
Well, for one thing, we were promised universal suffrage, which means that we could elect our own chief executive in the year 2008. And right now we are in 2019 and we do not see that happening anytime soon. Beijing has put forward some rules where they have said that they would be the ones choosing the candidates for people to elect, which of course means it's not a real universal suffrage. No, just in this very basic sense of the one country, two systems, it is just not working.
So protesters have set a new deadline today for the government to respond to their demands. What are you demanding?
We are at the moment still demanding for the extradition bill to be withdrawn, where the government, they have said that the bill is dead, but obviously for us it is just a word play, because there is no legal term as in, you know, the bill is dead. You have to either withdraw it or you can delay it, but you cannot suspend it. There is no such thing as suspension. So this is the prominent thing. And then also we are requesting for, you know, those who have been unjustifiably arrested just to release them. And because we have seen a lot of police brutality, police arresting people for no reason on the streets. And for myself, I think eventually I do believe that we have to come back to the question of universal suffrage. It's only when we can really elect our own legislative council and chief executive officer, that is when we can really have control over our own legal and judicial system.
So you're an activist and a celebrity. Evidently, you're also a cat owner. What difference does it make when a famous singer says these things as opposed to someone like, you know, activist Joshua Wong, who only has activist credentials?
For one thing, it raises curiosity, I guess.
Does celebrity status give you a level of safety? Like, are you concerned for your own safety right now?
I have a lot of friends who are concerned for my safety after my speech in the UN. But personally, I do believe, you know, what you said just now is right. My celebrity might be somewhat of a protection for me right now.
Denise Ho in Hong Kong, thanks very much for speaking with us.
No, thank you, Malcolm. Thank you.
The viewing of this video emitted 8.7 grams of CO2.
All right. Imagine hearing a message like that at the end of a video you just watched on the internet. Would you still watch it? Maybe not. Because a recent study of the carbon footprint of information and communications technology came to a sobering conclusion. All that data that's flying around the world, well, sending and receiving it, and manufacturing the technology to do that, it creates more carbon pollution than air travel, and that footprint is growing fast. Maxime Fouy-Hess is with the Shift Project, a climate think tank based in Paris. He's an author of the report. So you found that information technology is responsible for almost 4% of global carbon emissions. And if I read your report correctly, most of that footprint comes from watching videos. Is that right?
Yes. The thing is that most of the data traffic in the world is online video. The carbon footprint of digital technologies comes from the production of all the devices and infrastructures and from using all of these devices and infrastructures.
So you're talking about production of the servers, like making them, and the spinning up of the servers when we sit down, say, at Netflix to watch a movie.
Yeah, exactly. In the whole data traffic in the world, you have 80% which come from video usage, from video viewing. So yes, most of our digital users comes from online videos.
Maxime, why is regular TV, which these days comes to us a lot through cable, why is that better?
We don't have any figures on that. But the thing is that cable TV broadcasts videos which you want to watch. You are turning on your TV to watch something. On the internet, online videos are something that are absolutely everywhere. If you want to like read an article on a website, suddenly you have an embedded video just starting to play, and it's just playing itself. And when it starts playing, you have to watch it because your brain is like attracted by everything moving. So that's the main difference. On the internet, videos are playing themselves and they are making you consume them. You don't have to ask them to be played.
Who's doing most of the watching? Is it roughly evenly distributed around the world?
We consume in US and Europe a lot more data than in India, for example. It's like factor 10 or 100. The thing is that digital economy in India is quickly changing because they buy a lot of smartphones. And I would say that in a few years, it will come to the exact same situation as we are here in terms of consumption of videos.
So what are the best ways that each of us can reduce our own online carbon footprint? Is it up to each of us to have some self-control and just watch less stuff that is streaming?
Yes. And more about self-control, I would rather say asking you just one question. Am I watching that video because I want to? Or am I watching it because I can, just like it's playing itself? Am I just watching it because it's auto-playing?
Maxime Fouy-Hess with the Shift Project in Paris. Thanks for speaking with us.
Thank you so much.
By the way, that piece of audio we played at the top about the carbon footprint of one short video, it's from a video produced by the Shift Project. It's called This Video is Bad for Climate Change. Thank you for watching. And you can find it, where else, on YouTube. But think before watching. Barbie is swapping her signature blonde locks for a red mullet. Mattel has released a David Bowie Ziggy Stardust Barbie. The World's Sarah Birnbaum reports.
So, newsflash, Barbie isn't especially woke when it comes to gender. I had dozens of Barbies in the 80s when I was growing up, and the main lesson I learned from Barbie is that if you ever grow up to be a doctor, make sure you wear a pink dress under your lab coat so you can go on a hot date after work.
Barbie. Dr. Barbie's into making her patients feel good. She's into checking them out like a doctor would. She's into changing fast for dates with Dr. Ken. We're into it too.
To be fair, Barbie has come a long way, or maybe long-ish way, since then. And just yesterday, Mattel released a gender-bending David Bowie Ziggy Stardust Barbie. Ziggy Stardust was one of David Bowie's androgynous alter egos. The character was an alien from Mars who had traveled to Earth to save rock and roll. Here's Bowie talking about it to the CBC in 1977.
I had to be very exaggerated in the beginning to defy people to put me into a category so that that would leave me room to work in.
Ziggy played guitar, jamming good with web and gilly.
When Bowie performed as Ziggy, he'd wear these elaborate costumes that weren't traditionally male or female. They'd range from kimonos to full-body leotards. And Ziggy Barbie is wearing a metallic jumpsuit with these amazing red platform boots, a red mullet hairdo, and a Ziggy Stardust gold circle painted on her forehead. The initial reaction to Ziggy Barbie and how forward-thinking on gender Mattel is being is mixed. On the one hand, it is an edgy choice. See, if Mattel had wanted to create a Bowie doll, they could have chosen the Bowie persona with the red and blue lightning bolt on his face, which you've probably seen on everything from beer cans to t-shirts. The fact that Mattel chose a gender-bending Bowie persona is modern of them. But does Mattel actually get it? I mean, Ziggy Barbie is still a female doll with boobs. She's not non-binary. Mattel isn't responding directly to these questions. They have released a statement saying the doll honors the cultural legacy of the musical genius who redefined rock and roll. And just in case you were wondering, Ziggy Barbie costs $50, and she's already sold out. So you might just have to wait for Major Tom Barbie. And no, I don't actually think that's a thing. For The World, I'm Sarah Birnbaum.
I'm Marco Werman. You're with The World. Monday is Amazon Prime Day, a bacchanalia of online shopping when the company rolls out all kinds of discounts. So no surprise, it's one of the busiest shopping days of the year for Amazon. And workers at Amazon's warehouses are relied upon to get the packages to the people.
We are the people who are behind the scene. We are the people who are behind the success of Amazon.
That's Guled Mohammed. He works at Amazon's fulfillment center in Shakopee, Minnesota. And he's organizing a worker strike on Monday to protest working conditions they say treat them as less than human. About 100 workers, mostly Somali and East African immigrants, are expected to walk off the job.
That's why we come out. You know, when Amazon, they don't listen to us inside, then we come out to our community.
Mohammed is himself a Somali immigrant, and he says without workers like him, Amazon would not be able to operate. But Mohammed says the environment in the warehouse can be intense. He says the workers are moving so fast that they may not realize how heavy something is when they initially pick it up to scan.
Sometimes it may fall down one of your legs or your foot, so you may get injured. Yeah, Amazon, they don't care us when we get injury, when we face it, you know, a problem inside Amazon.
Amazon's fulfillment centers employ a lot of immigrants. Mohammed says that puts them at a disadvantage in the workplace.
They are new in the country. They don't know that much about their rights.
Mohammed has no plans to leave Amazon. He even says he's proud to work there.
It doesn't mean that we don't like Amazon, but it means that we love Amazon. We stay in Amazon, but we need a change so that Amazon will, you know, get in a better place.
A small glimpse behind the scenes there from one Amazon worker planning on walking out on Amazon Prime Day on Monday. Conflict in Sudan has been nonstop. Just last night, Sudan's ruling military council says it foiled an attempted coup. Several people were arrested and detained, among them current and former officers from the military and intelligence service. This is seen by the military council as an obstruction to its power-sharing deal with pro-democracy demonstrators that's in the process of being finalized. If this sounds complicated, it is. So to really understand all of this, we need to go back to a massacre of civilians on June 3rd. A new investigation by BBC Africa Eye uncovers evidence that the attack on protesters that day was ordered from the top and planned in advance.
We can now bring you a detailed eyewitness view of the violence that was inflicted on protesters on June 3rd.
Ben Strick is the lead investigative journalist at BBC Africa Eye and joins us now from London. This is pretty tough stuff to watch. What did that massacre look like?
The massacre was horrible, let's just say that. And in all honesty, we're leaving it really up to the footage to show that. What we've done in this is basically used the footage from all of these protesters who are actually quite brave enough to film it and upload it and get it out to the world. And it's really been able to show us exactly what's happened. So rather than just telling people there's a massacre in Sudan, a lot of people have died, we can show people for the first time how it happened, when it happened, and more importantly, where it happened as well.
You at BBC Africa, I analyzed over 300 cell phone videos of this massacre in Khartoum that morning. What did you find?
That's right. So when we initially analyzed it, I mean, it's quite difficult to make sense of 300 videos when it's so much panicking. What we were able to find is exactly when the gunshots happened and other things such as finding out exactly how things unfolded when the RSF attacked peaceful protesters at the sit-in in Khartoum that morning.
These are not just ordinary soldiers. I mean, they're part of the Janjaweed militia and under the leadership of a man with a pretty savage reputation.
You're right, you're right. And a very highly trained paramilitary force. So if you can imagine that going up against peaceful protesters who have never picked up a weapon in their lives, have never seen this sort of action before, you know, it's that's where it's scary to watch.
Ultimately, what is the finding of your investigation, aside from this was a terribly violent day?
The main finding of our investigation is that it wasn't just an attack. It was a calculated and military strategic dispersal and attack and a massacre of the sit-in.
Wasn't the internet shut down through a lot of these protests, the biggest ones? So are you saying like three people managed to get a live stream out in that time that the net was shut down?
So what happened was the internet was actually shut down at about 9 or 10 a.m. that morning. So it was shut down after the attack on the sit-in, but it was shut down at that point where most people who would have gone to the hospital, who would have sought shelter and then checked their phone to upload things, they couldn't do that. And it was shut down for a complete month and it was only restored over the past few days.
What was the most shocking thing you discovered in this video?
One of the most shocking things that we came across was the way that the bodies, so the dead people, were dispersed. We found evidence of bodies that were thrown in the river, in the Nile River in Khartoum. They were thrown in the river with blocks tied to their feet. We were questioning whether, you know, how humans could be capable of that.
I recall another investigation by BBC Africa Eye of some suspicious killings of civilians in Cameroon. Is this typically the kind of work that Africa Eye does?
That's correct. So we are a digital unit of BBC Africa Eye. I worked on that case myself. It's Anatomy of a Killing in Cameroon. And yes, this is a new take that we're trying to bring to investigative journalism, which is having a look at a more forensic approach and a digital approach, such as using shadows to calculate things and using satellite imagery to prove where something actually happened.
Protests in Khartoum are taking place again today. How do you think live streaming helped the protesters and will impact their movement in the future?
I think live streaming and even just filming videos has helped so much, because for Sudan at the moment, it's very hard for journalists to get access to these areas where this is happening. When there's no journalists there, it really stops any sort of coverage of what's actually happening. And this is the reason why protesters are sending us so much footage, because they want to know that they're being watched and that someone's actually out there watching over them.
Ben Strick led the BBC Africa Eye investigation into the June 3rd massacre in Khartoum, Sudan. Ben, thanks very much for your time.
Thank you so much.
The Nile River runs through Khartoum and flows north to Cairo. That's one way Sudan is connected to Egypt. Culturally, it's connected as well, and this man and his music represent one of the grooviest connections. مبروك مبروك Ali Hassan Kuban, no longer with us. He died in 2001. But the music he recorded in the 70s and 80s has staying power. He fused American soul and pop with the slinky melodies of Nubia, the region that straddles southern Egypt and northern Sudan. And that made him one of the most in-demand wedding singers along the Nile. His fusion also earned him the James Brown-inspired title, Godfather of Nubian Soul. This is Mabruk, one of Ali Hassan Kuban's biggest hits. You're with the world.
Hi, I want to tell you about a new PRX podcast called Things That Go Boom. It's all about foreign policy, but not in the way you might think. At Things That Go Boom, they tell stories about our lives and the world around us in an effort to better understand the ins, outs, and what have yous of what keeps us safe. On the new season, they tell the story of the secret back-channel meetings, political ploys, and even broken bones that led to the Iran nuclear deal. And since President Trump yanked us out of that deal, they ask, are we headed for nuclear war? Things That Go Boom's second season, called Fallout, is available now. Listen on Apple Podcasts or wherever you get your podcasts.
If you're a military official in Turkey, you probably have a lot on your mind.
He said, Ben, every morning I wake up, I've got Russia to the north, the Caucasus to the east, Iran, Iraq, Syria to the south, and the Balkans to the west. It's a hell of a neighborhood.
That's why the fight over Turkey's weapon systems is a big one. That story is still ahead on The World. I'm Marco Werman, and you're with The World. We're a co-production of the BBC World Service, WGBH Boston, PRI, and PRX. Turkey has started taking delivery of the S-400, and I'm not talking about a Mercedes sedan here. The S-400 is a Russian-made anti-aircraft missile system. Russian technicians also arrived to help assemble the system. This is a big deal because Turkey is a member of NATO, the North Atlantic Treaty Organization. The alliance was set up after World War II to counter the spread of Moscow's influence. And you just can't plug the weapon system of a hostile nation like Russia into NATO's own systems. Ben Hodges was commander of the U.S. Army in Europe from 2014 to 2017. He's retired from the Army and now works at the Center for European Policy Analysis. General Hodges, maybe we should start by explaining why Turkey is a critical member of NATO. Why is that?
Hey, Marco. Well, thanks. Turkey has been a very, very important member of the alliance since 1949. And in the original construct, their critical role was to help with containment of the Soviet Union around the greater Black Sea region. And no matter who was in power in Turkey or what else was going on, you could always count on Turkey as a reliable ally in a very, very important geographical location.
And how important has NATO been to Turkey? How much have they relied on NATO?
Well, it's the same thing. I remember about 4 years ago, I was speaking with the chief of plans and policy from the Turkish general staff, and he said, "Ben, every morning I wake up, I've got Russia to the north, the Caucasus to the east, Iran, Iraq, Syria to the south, and the Balkans to the west. It's a hell of a neighborhood." And so it's been beneficial for Turkey to be a member of the most successful alliance in the history of the world as well. That doesn't mean it's been easy. That doesn't mean there haven't been challenges and friction, but that's the nature of coalitions.
Explain to us laypeople why the Russian-made S-400 just can't be plugged into NATO's air defense network.
Well, there's two primary reasons why this is a problem. First of all, the S-400 is not going to be compatible with the F-35.
That's the warplane.
Right. The F-35, incredible aircraft, is going to give us a huge advantage for many, many, many years to come. And so that's why so many of our allies are purchasing it, including Turkey. But part of what makes it so effective is its stealth capability. And so if you have one country that has this aircraft and the S-400, then the radar associated with the S-400 can be trained to detect the F-35. And so there's no way we would allow the F-35 to be owned by somebody that also has the radar associated with S-400. So that's why it's completely unacceptable. And then, of course, the other reason that this is a problem is because of CATSA, the law that was passed last year is going to require sanctions. So we have a problem for Turkey in that not only are they not going to have the F-35.
Sanctions by the U.S., that is.
That's correct. I'm sorry. Not only are they not going to have the F-35, but their role as one of the nations producing components for the F-35 is going to end. So the big loser in this whole thing, unfortunately, is Turkey.
Yeah, I mean, beyond the sanctions you mentioned, there have also been calls for Turkey to be suspended from NATO. What do you think about that?
I think that would be a terrible mistake. Turkey is such an important ally, and I think we've got to think strategically, long-term, beyond President Erdogan's term. He's there probably, I think his next election is 2023, while Turkey USA version 1.0 is probably going to die this summer in terms of a relationship. We have to think about Turkey USA and NATO Turkey 2.0, life after President Erdogan. The purchase of the S-400 was an Erdogan purchase. This was not an institutional purchase. We've got to think beyond him and to push Turkey out of the alliance or somehow something that lessens their importance, I think would be a terrible mistake.
Well, I mean, if Erdogan stays, this move by Turkey taking this Russian S-400 gear, I mean, that could seriously threaten the relationship between the U.S. and Turkey.
Of course, this is a challenge. This is big stuff. But what I hope is that all of us on both sides will recognize that it's time for a new geostrategic framework for the relationship with Turkey as an essential member of NATO. We cannot afford to lose Turkey, but Turkey cannot afford to lose its relationship with the West. And this is exactly what the Kremlin wants. They've got so many leverage points over Turkey. We've got to figure out a way to help Turkey resist that.
Lieutenant General Ben Hodges, retired as a former commander of the U.S. Army in Europe. Thank you very much for being with us.
Thanks for the opportunity, Marco.
Here in the U.S., it can seem as if we've never been as divided over immigration as we are right now. But here's a thought that might give you some added perspective on that.
We are a nation of immigrants, but we are also a nation that loves to debate immigration policy. And that's been true since day one.
That's Bill Hing, a law professor at the University of San Francisco. He spent decades working on immigration, and he spoke recently with The World's Monica Campbell.
Bill Hing recently went through history and recent presidents to look at immigration, and he began with President Jimmy Carter in one critical moment.
Between midnight and noon today, 23 boats filled with over 800 Cubans reached Key West, Florida.
Jimmy Carter gave a speech near the end of his administration welcoming refugees to the United States, and Fidel Castro actually took him at heart and release many people from Cuban prisons and from mental institutions and put them on flotillas. The Carter administration did accept most of those Cubans into the United States. Some of the criminals he put in jail.
Dictatorships and civil wars also triggered mass migration from Central America in the 80s during Ronald Reagan's presidency. At first, Reagan denied asylum to many of the migrants.
But at the same time that they were denying asylum to Guatemalans and Salvadorans, Ronald Reagan went ahead and signed IRCA, the Immigration Reform and Control Act. It did grant amnesty to about 3 million undocumented immigrants. And so President Reagan recognized that undocumented immigrants actually benefited the United States.
The border itself, the infrastructure around it, was also far different then.
The border in the 1980s, it wasn't militarized. It wasn't until the Clinton administration when Operation Gatekeeper is implemented.
It is wrong and ultimately self-defeating for a nation of immigrants to permit the kind of abuse of our immigration laws we have seen in recent years, and we must do more to stop it.
They close off the border in the easiest places to cross, and they put up double, triple fencing, and they begin to use high technology with infrared, with body heat sensors. Bill Clinton actually lays the groundwork for what we have today.
Fast forward to George W. Bush, the creation of Homeland Security, and in 2003, the creation of ICE, Immigration and Customs Enforcement.
We have a responsibility to enforce our laws. We have a responsibility to secure our borders.
They passed the Fence Act in 2006, and I might add that two prominent Democratic senators voted for the Fence Act, Hillary Clinton and Barack Obama. They actually both voted for this bill that would have built a fence all along the southern border. Just it never got fully funded. That's obviously laid the groundwork for Mr. Trump's rhetoric on building a wall.
If we can imagine Trump reaching into a toolbox when it comes to immigration, what are some of the tools that he's reaching for right now?
The one tool that Barack Obama unnecessarily used that Mr. Trump has taken full advantage of is the detention of families.
A federal judge has ordered the release of thousands of women and children from immigrant detention centers in Pennsylvania and Texas.
President Obama admitted all along that he was being tough on immigration enforcement in order to bring Republicans to the bargaining table.
There are more Border Patrol agents and surveillance resources on the ground than at any time in our history. And we deport almost 400,000 migrants each year.
After a certain point, I'm not believing entirely his argument that he was being tough to bring Republicans to the bargaining table. I wonder if President Obama just had similar sentiment toward the border and toward undocumented immigrants. It's something that he's never fully addressed since leaving office.
What would be your recommendation for attending to hundreds of thousands of people coming to the U.S. over the course of this year?
What I would recommend as we exercise the humanitarian nature that is in all of us, I would hope. I'm not expecting that every person who comes to the United States be granted asylum or protection. They should be afforded due process. But right now, we're not even giving a fair chance for people to tell their stories.
University of San Francisco law professor Bill Hing, he was speaking there with The World's Monica Campbell. In Argentina, women have been taken to the streets for years to protest against femicide. They say the country's institutions aren't doing enough to fight Argentina's high rate of murders specifically targeting women. From Buenos Aires, The World's Alison Herrera has our story.
Marcela Juan's desk is cluttered with cups of mate, drawings by her 9-year-old daughter, and case files. Lots of case files. Juan is a prosecutor in Lomas de Zamora, on the outskirts of Buenos Aires. She pulls a file from the towering stack. It's the case of a young woman and her daughter who were stabbed to death. Juan is prosecuting the woman's husband for murder.
Family members noticed she had become isolated. Her husband made her change her phone number, and he also cut her off from her other children.
Juan specializes in cases of domestic violence and femicide, the killing of women and girls because they're female. Her legal assistant, Roxana Fontana, says these cases follow a disturbing familiar pattern.
Personas que están inmersas en lo que se llama el círculo de la violencia, que no realizan.
Some women, they get caught up in a cycle of violence, but they don't seek restraining orders. They hide the violence from their family and friends, and they end up being victims of femicide, she says. In Argentina, at least one woman per day has been the victim of femicide since the start of this year, says Marcela Juan. And violence against women in general is on the rise here. But women are not taking it quietly. Hundreds of thousands of women participated in a nationwide strike in October of 2016 to protest the kind of violence they say they've been enduring for decades. The hashtag Ni Uno Menos, or Not One Less, started to circulate after the death of a 16-year-old girl named Lucia Perez, who was drugged, raped, and beaten so badly she died from her injuries. Since then, there have been more protests and more hashtags, including Argentina's own version of Me Too, when an actress named Thelma Fardin accused a co-star of rape late last year.
I'm Laura Escurra. I'm from Argentina, Buenos Aires.
Laura Escurra was one of the actresses who came out in support of Fardin.
We started to talk about abuse in our profession, and a lot of women in different parts of societies started to talk about that she feels the same feeling.
And all that talk has led to some legislative action. In December, Argentina passed Micaela's Law, named for a 21-year-old student who was murdered in 2017. The law is designed to provide training for judges and law enforcement on how to deal with cases of gender violence. And the actress Thelma Fardin is working with lawmakers on a bill that would remove the statute of limitations involving crimes of sexual abuse. Congresswoman Carla Pitiot says despite the level of violence against women in Argentina, the laws are actually a model in the region.
Nosotros, la figura del femicidio fue incorporada recientemente en nuestro código penal. Estoy hablando.
Femicide was recently included in our penal code because there are women who are killed for the simple fact that they're women. So this isn't just any crime.
Pitiot is part of a group of lawmakers trying to take action against domestic violence. In January, they called for President Mauricio Macri to declare a state of emergency after a surge in femicide cases were reported nationwide. Pitiot says the laws need to be paired with preventative efforts like domestic abuse hotlines and shelters. And this requires money, but Argentina is facing budget cuts.
Todo esto de lo que hablamos, sin dinero, es imposible.
Everything we're talking about is impossible if there's no money actually earmarked by the state to guarantee women a life without violence. There needs to be political action, or else we won't be able to decrease the number of women who die.
Marcela Juan, the prosecutor, she agrees that prevention is key. And she says after more than 20 years prosecuting cases of violence against women, she's glad the issue is finally getting so much public attention.
Que alguien haga voz de los que sufren.
I think giving voice to their suffering helps to raise awareness and visibility. Violence has always existed, but what is happening now is that the situation has become overwhelming.
Argentina needs to solve this problem, she says. We can't keep looking away. For the world, Alison Herrera, Buenos Aires.
Alison's reporting in Argentina is supported by the International Women's Media Foundation. Argentine women are also fighting another battle over abortion. See the portraits of 12 women fighting for reproductive rights in Argentina at theworld.org. Trump's tariffs may be coming home to roost. U.S. exports of goods to China fell off a cliff in June, down 31% compared with the same time a year ago. Going the other way, we're also buying less stuff from China, 8% less. That's according to the latest Chinese customs data. The world's Jason Margolis has been following the U.S.-China trade war and joins me now in the studio. What's going on, Jason? Why is this happening?
So as you know, there's a trade war between the U.S. and China. We were just talking on June 1st. President Trump raised tariffs on $200 billion worth of Chinese imports from 10% to 25%. China retaliated, and here we are.
So that's it? It's that simple?
If only it were that simple. So there's a lot of things going on. Yeah. So let's unpack a few. First, there's the dollar exchange rate. The dollar is strong. So what that means is our exports are less attractive out there. The other thing is the Chinese economy is slowing down. So Chinese consumers are buying less. But I also spoke with economist Lee Brandstetter at Carnegie Mellon University in Pittsburgh. We spoke earlier today. And here's what he said about what's going on.
It's hard not to come to the conclusion when looking at these numbers that President Trump's trade war with China is really backfiring for U.S. business. China is retaliating to his tariffs by raising tariffs on a range of U.S. goods. That makes U.S. producers uncompetitive in the incredibly important Chinese market. They're losing market share to producers based in other countries.
So what does somebody like Brandstetter have to say about the fact that, you know, 31% drop in imports from the U.S. in China? I mean, that's serious, right?
It is serious, but he also adds some caveats. So it is serious in that the trade relationship is slowing down. Now, there are a lot of different ways to look at trade data, and it's very confusing. This is why Brandstetter offers caution. First of all, when you look at monthly data, maybe Boeing is selling a few less airplanes, and that can really skew the numbers. Can I tell a quick diversion about a reporting trip to Mississippi 10 years ago? We were looking at trade data about 10 years ago during the height of the Great Recession, and 49 states had a negative trade balance except for Mississippi. We said, what is going on? Why is this happening? We called all these trade experts. No one knew. We looked at the census data. We called the census. No one could figure it out. Finally, we found out there was a chicken producer in Mississippi that had frozen all of his chicken. It was on the port of Pascagoula. They had this frozen chicken that they were not going to export until Eastern Europe paid their bills. And then they decided, all right, they paid their bills, we're going to send it out. And that skewed all the trade data for that month.
Incredible.
Something like that could be happening with China in June, but we don't know exactly because you can't dissect the numbers yet. And it's very, very hard to get to the root of what's causing this.
So that's a really telling story. Also, aren't trade statistics just generally misleading?
Exactly. We're not trading an avocado for an olive. That's not the way it works. We're trading these manufactured goods. And I spoke with Stephen S. Cohen, who's a professor emeritus at UC Berkeley. And this is what he said about the way modern trade works.
If you look at what we produce in this country, 25-30% of just about any darn thing consists of imported components. Even the stuff coming out of China towards us, they're not exactly Chinese exports. They're bundles. The bundles have been made in China. So these supply chains are very complicated and very long.
So what Cohen is basically saying is just take the iPhone. That's the classic example. A lot of those components come from other parts of Asia, the United States. It's assembled in China and then sent back to the U.S., and that counts as an export, a $600 export for China. But is it really? You can look at the trade data, but it doesn't tell the whole picture.
Are the U.S. and China going to sit down again and talk this through?
That's the plan. They say they're going to, but there's no specifics for when President Xi and President Trump will meet.
Just remind us, finally, Jason, what is Trump wanting from this whole tariff business? What's his end game?
So if I could give you a one-sentence answer, it would be for China to play by the rules. And what does that mean? Well, China does a lot of things that the U.S. and other countries don't like. For example, China forces the transfer of technology. If you're a U.S. company, you want to do business in China, they say, fine, you can set up shop, but you got to tell us how you build your stuff. And the U.S. says, we don't like that. We don't want that to happen anymore. China also subsidizes a lot of its companies. The U.S. doesn't like that. So Trump's strategy is if we put tariffs on China, they'll come to the table. They'll talk to us. Thus far, it doesn't appear to be working.
The world's Jason Margolis on the big drop in U.S. exports to China last month. Thanks very much.
Thank you, Marco.
Fans of British singer Kate Bush have a date tomorrow to observe the most Wuthering Heights day ever. If you don't know this Kate Bush standard, Wuthering Heights, let me explain. Her fans around the globe, women and men, are going to convene in open meadows, grassy fields, and maybe some windy moors in flowy red dresses, matching stockings, and green eyeshadow. They'll frolic and they'll dance, all in an effort to recreate the music video Kate Bush released in 1978, even before MTV. Don't know the moves? Don't worry, you can learn them online.
Out on the Wiley, bring your hand across your body. Out on the
Wiley. Yeah, a little rehearsing with her and you two can do Kate Bush's interpretive dance. The first Wuthering Heights flash mob took place 6 years ago. The British performance troupe Shambush organized it and then released a video of 300 people in red dresses dancing to the tune. Since then, the idea's gone global. From Berlin to Dublin to Sydney, you'll find Wuthering Heights video reenactments. Ahead of tomorrow's big day, fans around the world have been rehearsing their moves and they take it real seriously.
Looking over to the right, you had a temper, back to the front, lower your head a bit, like my jealousy.
Kate Bush wrote Wuthering Heights when she was just 18. The tune, of course, inspired by Emily Bronte's novel. When Kate Bush released the song and video in 1978, it was the height of the punk movement in Britain. Let's just say music fans had never seen or heard anything like it. After that, Kate Bush went on to become one of the most successful female recording artists in UK history. Tomorrow, if you happen to come across a crowd of dancers in red dresses, you'll know what it's all about. Dancing and frolicking with them, that's your choice.
Then right, how could you leave me? Then to the left, when I needed to. Then to the right, possess you. Then straight up, we do the prayer. I hated you. And then coming up, I loved you too.
I frolic out of here. That's it from us today. The world's theme music is by Ned Porter. We come to you from the Nan and Bill Harris studios at WGBH in Boston. I'm Marco Werman. Have yourselves a great weekend.